They're our closest companions and loyal friends, and many people will tell you that they often know what their dogs are thinking, that they look at them with adoring eyes and smile when they're happy. But in reality, their inner lives are not that easily accessed or well understood. The hearts and minds of dogs is the subject of today's edition of Please Explain. And joining us are John Bradshaw, the director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol in the UK, author of Dog Sense, How the New Science of Dog Behavior Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. It's published by Basic Books. And Alexandra Horowitz, assistant professor of psychology at Barnard College and director of the Dog Cognition Lab and the author of Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. It's published by Scribner's. Welcome to today's Please Explain.
Thanks very much.
Very pleased to be here.
And John, since we're speaking to you all the way from, is it Southampton?
That's right, yeah.
We should start with you. What's understood about how dogs become dogs? How much have they evolved from wolves?
Well, dogs have evolved from wolves. I mean, there used to be an idea that some breeds of dog had some jackal blood in them, but the DNA revolution that we've seen over the past 20 years or so has essentially confirmed that dogs are just wolves. And even more than that, they're actually not descended from American wolves. All the dogs we have around us, including ancient American breeds, are descended from wolves that came from Europe and or Asia. The argument is still a little bit about which one of those two was first. The most likely story is that the wolf was domesticated in several places, and then the bloodlines merged much later on as people moved the animals around.
So they're tamed wolves, in effect, who were then brought to all the four corners of the world.
Yes, I think initially they would have been tamed wolves. I have a theory that, in fact, they tamed themselves, that they were indeed the first animal to be domesticated. There were no precedents for any of that. We're talking about a time before agriculture when we were essentially hunter-gatherers. We as humans might stay in one place for a few months at a time, but we were probably migrated around a lot as well. One theory goes that wolves just kind of followed us around. The wolves in those days were not the same as the wolves we have today. They were much easier to integrate into our society. And so I think the process was one of evolution rather than domestication.
But do they still have characteristics in common with wolves that we tend to misunderstand?
I don't think they have very. I think the misunderstanding comes from trying to assume that dogs are unreconstructed or virtually unreconstructed wolves, rather than the other way around. I mean, dogs are wolves under the skin. The DNA is more than 99% the same, but they're not wolves in many other senses. Really, they're canids. They're dogs, members of the dog family, but. The behavioral differences between dogs and wolves are so profound that I think making comparisons between the two certainly in the past, have been unhelpful.
Alexandra, since there are so many different varieties and they range from tiny to the size of a small pony, what is it that makes them all dogs?
Well, I think that it's an interesting question, what actually makes a dog. I think we kind of come to dogs thinking that we already know what makes a dog, and there are different answers depending on your scientific perspective. From a biological perspective, it is that genetic similarity and the fact that they share some common traits, like interest in humans, for instance, interest in affiliation with humans, as opposed to interest in distancing oneself from humans. And there are a lot of behaviors that then fall out of that really increase this sense that they're interested in us and we allow them to be our companions, like their interest in looking us in the eyes. That's something you don't see in wolves, in the current wolves, and we don't know what the ancestors were like, but we don't see it in our current gray wolf. And it really makes it feel as though dogs are kind of one of us or understand us.
Although we'll get into how that may be a subject of misunderstanding, despite the great disparities, can they all interbreed?
They can interbreed, as far as I know. John, do you want to correct me on that?
Even the teeny ones with the huge ones?
Yeah.
Yeah, the breeds, all the breeds of dog can interbreed. Sometimes it's mechanically a little bit difficult, but it can happen. And, of course, dogs can interbreed with wolves as well. And that
that makes them different than chimps and humans.
It's a much bigger difference. The difference between chimps and humans is a much bigger difference than the difference between wolf and dog. Wolf and dog are the same species, to all intents and purposes. There are wolf-dog hybrids, which are very unpredictable and dangerous animals, but some people like them. There have been hybridizations, crosses between wolves and dogs historically. I think some of the sled dog breeds have some fairly recent wolf ancestry in them. So the two have continued to interbreed. On the fringes, I suppose, of the dog population, most of our domestic dogs trace their ancestry back as dogs for 10,000 years or more.
You know, even the Canis familiaris is the Linnaean name for the dog, but some people call them Canis lupus familiaris, just indicating they're sometimes considered a subspecies of wolves, not their own species.
Well, I forgot to mention that we invite listener calls during these segments. Our number here is 646-829-3985. That's 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. John, you seem to suggest that the relationship between dogs and human beings and the way they became so deeply connected to each other began as a decision by the dogs or the wolves that later became dogs?
Well, I don't think it was a human decision. I mean, maybe we're just kind of slightly glorifying it by giving it the description decision anyway. I think it was just an evolution that a certain type of wolf that we now know nothing about because they're not extinct, they're dogs, but they don't exist in the wild anymore. That kind of wolf found a way of living alongside people. Now, we don't know precisely what that was. It goes back so far, we're talking about before written history, almost before art. So there's no way of getting it from the record. All we can do is speculate. And my favorite theory is that people went out, as they do still do in some parts of the world, and collected young animals, particularly women and children would collect young animals just to look after and as pets, if you like. That some of those young animals were wolf cubs, that they were brought back into villages. They grew up thinking that people were their parents because that's who they'd been raised by, and the relationship took off from there. But I don't think it was a decision. I think it just happened.
And it's not the same sort of thing with cats, although we have made cats pets for a fairly long time as well, haven't we?
Yes, indeed. Again, I think what happened with the cat, I mean, we're talking about probably 5,000 or 6,000 years later, so, you know, into the agricultural era when we'd started farming, we had barns full of grain, which were then, you know, attracted pests, and then the pests, the mice and so on, would attract cats, and then somebody, I guess, thought, the evidence suggests anyway, that somebody thought, well, wouldn't it be a good idea to keep these cats around to frighten the mice away? And so the earliest domestic cats were probably more like captive cats. They were just tied up in a granary to keep the mice away, and then pet keeping of the cat developed from there. But, you know, it's a much later development. The human society was much more modern then than it was right back in the hunter-gatherer era when the dog first appeared.
So let's talk about how they experienced the world. Alexandra, how much do we know? Can you tell us what we understand about how they see and hear and smell?
Well, there is a lot of good biological evidence about their sensory understanding, their perceptual abilities, and I think we can reasonably extrapolate from that and form an image of what it might be like to a dog to experience the world. Although, in some ways, that's an impossible question, you know, knowing how a non-linguistic species experiences the world. But, you know, I would say if we had to imagine how they experience the world, it is with nose first. In other words, theirs is an olfactory world more than it is a visual world, and that's difficult for us as humans to understand because we're so perceptually provincial. We assume the sort of what's out there is what we see out there, and dogs and almost every other non-human animal are good evidence that we're missing a lot of the really sensory stimuli. Dogs' nose is much more developed than ours. Their olfactory cortex and their brain is much more developed. They have another organ called a vomeronasal organ to smell hormones in the air. So I think that the way they view the world is as a world of sense first.
Why do they lick our hands when we pet them?
Well, there are a lot of possible reasons for that. I mean, they lick a lot of things. The tongue is one way of getting information about the world. First, because, you know, they don't have hands. Their mouth is really their way of operating on the world, as any dog owner knows. But also, that tongue will bring molecules of odor to be dissolved and interpreted, such as it is, by the vomeronasal organ. So they're getting information about you. And you have your own signature odor, and every person does, and some of that information might be about who you are, in addition to whatever, you know, lotion you put on your hands, which they find agreeable.
Now, John, you mentioned that much of a dog's behavior may be attributed to nurture, because they're exposed to humans in puppyhood, and that shapes their behavior?
Yes, it is in a way. I mean, I think what we have is an animal which is programmed right from the almost the minute its eyes open to learn about people in a way that no other animal is. But they do have to learn it. They must have some kind of ideas to what the difference between a human and a dog is right from the get-go. But then everything else after that is learned. They learn how to interact with us. They learn what we like and what we don't like. They learn about different kinds of humans. You know, they're just because a dog has met adults doesn't mean it knows what a child is. You need to introduce a dog to both adults and children in its puppyhood if it's to get on with children later on in life. But this learning does seem to be very specialized. And it's so focused that we don't think there's any other animal which learns about people in such an intense way, except, of course, people themselves.
But some of us who live with dogs get the feeling that they look deeply in our eyes with love and loyalty, and also a kind of longing to reach some greater understanding of us. Are we just imagining that?
No, I think they are trying to. I think they spend their whole lives trying to find out more about us. I think domestication has developed them to try to bond with us whenever they can, and obviously that's good for them. I mean, a dog that doesn't like people, isn't going to get fed by people, isn't going to get looked after, therefore isn't going to have any puppies. So it's a survival instinct. They've chosen their way of life, which is to live with people, and they've developed that. They've developed the ability to do that exceptionally well, and they go on trying to learn more about us all through their lives. But there are limitations to this. There's some very interesting experiments done in France where some dogs that were owned by blind people, these are guide dogs that lead blind people around, and what was found was that even though they'd lived with these people for 2, 3, 4 years, they still gazed into their eyes to try and find out what was going on. And now a blind person's eyes don't give much away. They may not even be facing their head in the right direction. So it's, although, of course, it works 99% of the time, it shows that this is actually a rather limited piece of behavior on the dog's part, which is a little bit channeled, is a bit narrow, and they don't necessarily adapt very well when they're confronted with situations where those very fixed pieces of behavior don't work so well.
Alexander, all of this is reminding me of a cartoon in The New Yorker a while back of a woman returning home to an excited dog, and she reads love into the dog's reaction. The balloon over her head is a heart. The balloon over the dog's head shows an open can of dog food.
Right. Well, as John said, they look to us because it is adaptive to look to us. That doesn't mean that then also in that gaze there isn't something approaching love. It's not a human-like love, but they surely have an affection for us.
Do they see us in terms of alpha dog, don't they, and some kind of hierarchy?
That's a kind of old-fashioned way of looking at or understanding dogs living with us that I really came from looking at wolf behavior, actually. Mid-20th century research looked at captive wolves and found that they formed hierarchies among themselves. But these weren't wolves in the wild. And when we look more closely at what that wolf situation was, they were captive adolescent male wolves who are all put in a confined situation together, sort of like looking at a prison population of humans and then extrapolating to all other humans. It might not be the best model. If we look at wolves in the wild, they live with families, and the parents of the pack are kind of alphas, but they're not dominating the younger animals, and neither do they look to us. I think they probably look to us as parents. They're part of our social unit, and we're part of theirs.
But people have had this experience. I had a dog and then left him with somebody else, and years later came back, and the dog came over and sat at my feet as though nothing had changed after all, over all those years.
Well, their memories are quite good. Sometimes I think we get the idea, because they're not constantly talking to us about their experiences, that they therefore have no memory. But of course they do, and you're easily recognizable, and I'm just surprised he didn't hold it against you.
Well, I was very kind to him when we were together. My guests are Alexandra Horowitz, assistant professor of psychology at Barnard College and director of the Dog Cognition Lab, author of Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. It's published by Scribner's. John Bradshaw is the director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol in Great Britain, and the author of Dog Sense, How the New Science of Dog Behavior Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. It's published by Basic Books. And our phone number here is 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. We'll be right back after this. We're back with John Bradshaw, the director of Anthrozoology, the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol, and also Alexandra Horowitz, assistant professor of psychology at Barnard College and director of the Dog Cognition Lab there. Before we get to the calls, and a reminder, our number here is 646-829-3985. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Maybe you could take a couple of moments to talk about the work that you do with dogs and what struck you most about who and what they are and how they see the world and how they behave. And we'll begin with you, John.
Well, I've got a number of things, a number of bits of research I've done on dogs, and I actually came into studying dogs through the sense of smell that Alexandra was talking about a little while ago. But the other strand, I think, is more to do with dog welfare and dog emotion, and we've specialized in looking at what are called separation disorders. I agree with Alexandra that dogs have a very special kind of love for us, a very special affection. It may not be identical to what we feel as affection, but it's as close as I think makes very little difference. The flip side of that is that they hate being left alone, and they do have a problem because their sense of time is not nearly as good as ours, and we think that they don't realize that we're coming home. You shut the door on the dog, the dog thinks you've gone forever, and many dogs get quite distressed as a result.
And bark and scratch at the door and
they'll do all
make
kinds
a mess.
Of things. Yeah. I mean, each dog does something slightly different, but quite often they suffer in silence. They don't make enough noise to alert the neighbor. So some people know that their dogs are upset when they're out, and others don't realize until maybe they leave a video camera on. We've got people to do that, and they've been quite shocked by what they've seen. This is about the dog's inability to predict the future in a way that it seems quite foreign to us. I think we could just sit down and say, okay, well, he's coming home. It's time for me to have a sleep. But it doesn't seem to work with dogs. So maybe one dog in five suffers quite badly from this sometime in the course of its lifetime. It's very easy to prevent. We've done a lot of research with the rehoming charities here to try and get good advice out about how to train your dog to relax when it's alone. And if you can do that, then you won't have any problems. If you don't, there's a big risk that you will, and that once you get a problem, it can be very difficult to fix.
Because you can't teach an old dog new tricks?
Because once they get into the habit of getting upset when you're out, it's almost inevitable that the dog is going to have to go on some kind of pharmaceutical to calm it down and then be retrained afterwards. So it could end up being pretty expensive if you fix it properly. They're so upset when they're left that they can't really learn about relaxing. If you teach them right from the get-go, then they're fine.
Alexandra?
Well, my research has been a little more cognitive because I came from a cognitive science background, and I was interested in human and animal cognition. So I started studying dogs as an interesting model for how we could learn from behavior about what's on the mind of an animal. I was studying dog play initially, and I did a lot of work on that, and that was very much about how they could use each other's attention in communicating to each other, and they did some pretty sophisticated moves there. And more recently, I've been doing experimental work examining the anthropomorphisms we make of dogs, in particular the attributions that we make to them. And so one of my studies was of the guilty look of dogs, of whether or not it appeared only when dogs did something for which they might feel guilty. And right now we're studying.
And what did you find out?
Well, what it looked like was that this guilty look, which is very recognizable and mostly most dogs have it, although it varies from dog to dog, appeared most often when they were about to be scolded or they were being scolded, not when they had done something disobedient. And actually, the most guilty look appeared tragically when they had not done anything wrong but were scolded as though they had. And so what it looks like is that this guilty look comes up as a kind of submissive behavior, I would really say an appeasement behavior in anticipation of a punishment, and in fact is often pretty good at avoiding punishment because it's a very cute look. But it doesn't necessarily indicate that the dog understands that it should feel guilty for his or her actions. It doesn't say that they don't feel guilty, but that's very hard to prove affirmatively. And I think we just assume it as owners. We use our own model for talking about other human psychology and place it on the dogs. And I think that can be to their deficit.
I'm talking with Alexandra Horowitz of Barnard College and John Bradshaw of the University of Bristol. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, let's take some calls. Our first caller is Philippe from Brooklyn. Hi, Philippe. You're on the air.
Oh hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm a young trainer starting out. My background is actually opera. I performed at the Met, but I've always dreamed of working with dogs. And I've been working with dogs every morning in Prospect Park with a company called Ava's Play Pops in Brooklyn. And we have 20 to 40 dogs off leash without fences every morning playing with about 5 to 8 people watching them. Since I've been there, we've been working on reorganizing the social structure. And we've noticed that dogs are very keyed into human posture. And by standing a certain way, whether your palms are facing up or down, a dog might run past you or notice you. And when they notice you, you're able to convince them that there's an imaginary line.
I think it's a great observation and that dogs are so attuned to you. I consider them almost anthropologists, tongue-in-cheek, among us, because they're watching what we do, and we don't realize what the salient moves are of our posture to them. Something as small as a palm up or down, or a slightly different facial expression, or a tense posture as opposed to a relaxed posture, can be perceived by a dog. And now what they interpret that as being is going to be contextual. And in your case, if they're interpreting it as being the edge of the social group, great. But the more you can do as an early young trainer in observing how dogs are responding to you and their experiential world, I think that the easier time you'll have convincing them to do what you want them to do.
Donna, go ahead, John.
Yeah, and it reminds me of a training session that was done by a trainer called Ian Dunbar, who's actually English, or he lives in San Francisco, but he did a TV series over here where he got owners to command their dogs to sit, which, of course, all the owners had done. And then he said, now do it without moving your body or your eyes or anything. Just say the words. And 9 out of 10 dogs had no idea what their owners were saying. Although we think they listen to what we're saying because we're humans and that's the way we communicate with each other, what their dogs, most dogs, are mainly picking up on is this body language. They're incredibly sensitive, as Alexandra was saying, to every gesture that we make, probably more sensitive than we are ourselves.
And when they're puppies, if you get down on your hands and knees and make a kind of a puppy-like gesture, they respond immediately. But they don't think we're puppies as well.
No, they don't. I mean, we've done some work with play signals where we get people to give, you know, dog-like play signals as far as we can. The play bow, you know, the bow that the dogs do where they stick their front feet out. You can get somebody to do that if you persuade them nobody's watching. dogs, they find that incredibly appealing. They love to see that, and it makes them play. But the way that they then play shows that they are perfectly aware that you are a human doing a dog thing and not a dog doing the same thing. They play in a much less competitive way with humans than they do with dogs. So they kind of react to things we do that bring us down, if we bring ourselves down to their level. But not for a minute, I think, are they confusing us with dogs. They're much smarter than that.
A listener asks, how is it possible that dogs have bred-in behavior? Would a herding dog who never saw another dog herding still show herding behavior? Is it truly built into their genes? And if so, how?
Sure. Well, it's not that herding per se is built into the genes. It's a sensitivity to a certain kind of motion or a certain kind of stimuli. And if you put them around sheep, then that's going to be the stimuli, and it's the motion of the sheep. And they're also sensitive. Herding dogs are also sensitive to handlers and the real small moves that a handler will make. Apropos the last caller, if you've ever watched a sheepdog handler, they make extremely tiny movements, and the dog seems to do an elaborate dance in response. There's a real communication there. But those sensitivities to stimuli and threshold to notice motion and so forth, and then a behavioral response that follows that, that's what's bred in, and that can manifest often most unfortunately in a situation where they don't want a dog to herd, say, the small children of the household or the people who are walking away from them in the park, but the dog has the urge to follow that motion.
Michelle in Brooklyn says, please discuss dogs in combat. I find it fascinating that dogs will jump out of planes.
Yeah, I mean, I've done quite a lot of studies of military dogs, and one of the things that struck me when I first was kind of allowed to go and observe dogs training with the military was the way that they train them. You'd think that that hard-bitten soldiers would train with pretty harsh methods, but in fact, certainly by the end of the 20th century even, they had gone over to using very gentle, reward-based training methods. And discouraging behavior by ignoring the dog. The dog, Cairo, that went in on the raid to get bin Laden would almost certainly have been trained to play, essentially, very, very roughly. I mean, that's how it's not a real attack in the dog's head. What it is an extremely rough game. And also, he would have been trained to detect explosives, firearms, and so on using his nose. Again, by making that fun. So he was probably having a better time than any of the humans in that house.
But what about the dogs that do attack children? Have they been trained to do that? Do they see it as play?
Well, I think
pit bulls, for example?
Yeah, I mean, a few of them may have been trained that way, and obviously that's a very irresponsible kind of dog ownership. I think it's not always one explanation for a dog attack on a child. It's obviously a very emotional event. It's something that should never happen. But when you kind of called in to look at what may have triggered it and therefore what maybe the fate of the dog ought to be, I think there's, you know, one explanation could be that dog has never been introduced to children before. It doesn't know what children are, how they behave, and the fact that they behave in a different way to adults. So the dog's expectations may be that, what is this child? Is it another species? Is it something I should be frightened of? Should I therefore maybe attack it in order to defend myself? It could be that the dog is playing much too roughly, and it could be in some instances we think that the dog actually doesn't recognize the child as a human being at all. It thinks it's something like a squirrel or a cat that it might want to chase, and of course the child doesn't run away, so a bite may result. So it's never simple when you're asked to look at one of these events.
Jay, who's calling us from Penn Station, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just have a very quick question. Recently, a Navy SEAL was killed over in Afghanistan, and there was an article in the Times about how the dog, his Labrador Retriever, wandered over to the casket and would not leave during the entire memorial service and laid there looking very forlorn. So how would they describe that behavior? And I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I think that's an interesting question. It does. That I saw that photo as well, and to me it does look like a kind of grieving. I mean, we have to realize that dogs are extremely tightly attached to their owners. They use a psychological term. They formed a very strong bond with the people with whom they live. And, you know, just it's not surprising at all to me that a dog would go to the odor of even a non-living person who had been in their family. And they'll notice an absence of somebody. Now, is the experience identical to that of a child who might have a now absent parent? I don't think it is identical to that of a child because the cognitive experience is different than from humans to dogs. But that's my impression, and John might have another take on it.
No, I think I would tend to agree with that. We don't think dogs have a concept of death. I mean, that's a clear distinction to be made. The finality of death is something that doesn't really appear in the human repertoire, perhaps until a child is 4 or 5 years old. There's no evidence that any animal has an idea of death as a concept. But, of course, what they can do and what they do is seek the attachment figure. It's just like a dog that's been left alone in the house. The dog wants to reattach itself, find its owner, if you like, and can't do that because the door's closed. Likewise, if somebody has died, then that person's dog will seek to and try to reattach themselves to that person. There was a case over here where a mountain rescue dog was with somebody doing mountain rescue. That person had a heart attack and died on the mountain. Wasn't found for about a day, and the dog was still lying beside him. I don't think the dog knew that the person was dead, that his handler was dead, but he did know that that was where he needed to be because that was where all good things came from.
Just one more thing. You mentioned that if a dog has this kind of separation anxiety and it isn't dealt with at a very early stage, it's going to be continue to be a serious problem. Are all of the problems that we may face with dogs correctable if we get them very, very early? And when is early?
Well, yes, I think in principle, I mean, there may be one or two complete pathologies with dogs, which are, you know, associated with medical conditions, which require a veterinarian to look at them. But the more common types of behavioral disorders, which might be a dog that is anxious or fearful and may even turn to being aggressive as a result of that, a dog that doesn't like being left alone, a dog that is badly trained, apart from anything else, those kinds of things are both preventable by correct upbringing and also curable, but again, cure is never as easy as prevention.
Thank you both so much for being with us on today's Please Explain. John Bradshaw is the director of the Anthrozoology Institute at the University of Bristol in the UK, author of Dog Sense, How the New Science of Dog Behavior Can Make You a Better Friend to Your Pet. It's published by Basic Books. Alexandra Horowitz is assistant professor of psychology at Barnard College and director of the Dog Cognition Lab and the author of Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. It's published by Scribner's. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks, Leonard.
Great pleasure.